So the question I'm going to start off with is what do we mean by realism in physics? Then talk a little about local realism and the EPR Bell setup. Then I'll just review three recent experiments on the EPR Bell situation. Then I'll go across to a rather different topic, the topic of macro realism, and talk about a recent experiment in that area. And here are the references for these various experiments. These three are now all published. This one, on which I'm undeservedly and rather remotely a co-author, is actually in the process of being reviewed, and we hope it's going to be published. Okay, so what do we or can we mean by realism in physics? If you ask a philosopher about what is and is not real, they will tend to discuss all sorts of things like, is the human mind real? Is the number five real? Are moral facts real? And somewhat closer to home, are atoms, electrons, photons, etc. real? But even in the last case, it really isn't that easy to think of what input we could actually make from physics about this. So the question is, in what sense can physics as such say something about realism? So, okay, one has to make some kind of zeroth order definition, and here is my proposed definition, that at any given time, the world does have a definite value of any property which can be measured on it, irrespective of whether or not that property actually is measured. Okay, this is just a sort of zeroth order proposition to shoot at, if you like. If we want to make this proposition experimentally testable, we do need to extend it to finite parts of the world rather than the world as a whole. If we just apply it to the world as a whole, it's going to be essentially impossible to test it. So the question I'm going to ask in both halves of this talk, really, is put aside for the moment the question of whether or not quantum mechanics is a universally valid theory of the world. I personally tend to think it isn't, but that's just maybe a prejudice. But let's put that aside and ask, can we say anything meaningfully about this proposition directly from experiment? Well, let's just consider the very simplest possible case, which is a simple two-state system, and we might as well start off with a very well-known microscopic example, which is photon polarization. So imagine an experiment which goes as follows. We take a single heralded photon. We do want to know that the photon is there, as it were, in the first place before we can say anything meaningful about it. We're going to shine that photon onto some kind of polarizer with, let's say, its transmission axis parallel to A. And basically, one of two things will then can then happen. And we know this, in some sense, directly from experiment. Either the photon will get transmitted through the polarizer, in which case it will enter a detector, for example, some kind of photomultiplier. As a result of this, something reasonably macroscopic will happen. I'll produce a current pulse from the anode or cathode. Anode, I think, of my photomultiplier. I always get confused. And as a result of that reasonably macroscopic output, there will be some kind of click in a counter, or some kind of printout on a computer tape, or some other kind of macroscopic event, which will basically tell us, yes, the photon did actually get transmitted through the polarizer. The alternative, of course, is the photon gets reflected, goes into a similar detector, similar photomultiplier. Again, something macroscopic will happen, and we'll get a printout or a click or whatever, which will give us the answer, no, the photon did not get through. So, crudely speaking, we're asking the photon a question, are you polarized along A or not? And it's an experimental fact that for each individual photon, and we know that there's a photon there, remember, because it is heralded. So for each individual photon, either the counter yes will click and the counter no will not, or n will click and y does not. So I think a fairly natural paraphrase of that situation is that when asked, each photon answers either yes, and let's denote that schematically by some variable a equals plus one, or no, which we'll denote by a equals minus one. But now, so far so good. Nothing particularly mysterious about that. What happens if the photon is not asked? Can we make any kind of statement about its polarization? Well, let's take a point of view which has been elaborated by Henry Stapp, Latasha Perez, and others, which goes something like the following. Here's our photon, and we have some kind of switch, and that switch will either propel the photon into the experimental device I showed just previously, where it'll be forced to answer the question, are you polarized along A or not? Alternatively, it might switch it in some different direction where it'll never encounter a polarizer. And suppose indeed it's a given photon is directed elsewhere, in other words, into some irrelevant region where it doesn't have to answer the question. What does it then mean to ask, does the photon have a definite value of A? A possible quasi-operational definition is the following. It goes as follows. Suppose the photon had been switched into the measuring device. So I'm making now a counterfactual supposition. Suppose it had been switched into the measuring device. Then we could actually formulate two propositions. And I don't think this is a point of English. When I discuss this point, I always invite those of the audience who are not have a different native language than English to try translating this text into their own language and see if it still makes sense. I think it does, but I'd be interested to hear any counter arguments for that. So first proposition is that it is a fact that either counter Y would have clicked, in other words, A equals plus one, or that counter N would have clicked, in which case A is minus one. Now, given that on all occasions in which we did actually switch it, one of these two things happened, then this proposition would seem, at least at first sight, rather a truism. But now we come to the second proposition. Either it is a fact that counter Y would have clicked, that is, A plus one, or it is a fact that counter N would have clicked, A equals minus one. So in other words, if we make proposition number two, which is macroscopic counterfactual definiteness, remember, it's a statement not about something that's going on in the micro world, it's a statement about real macroscopic events, like counters clicking or not clicking or whatever, or bells ringing. So if we make this statement, then we are basically asserting that counterfactual statements have truth values. Now, do they? Well, of course, this is a topic which has been argued over extensively by philosophers long before we had to worry about anything like quantum mechanics or so forth. And various points of view have been expressed by professional philosophers on this question. However, what I would like to just draw attention to at this stage of the argument is that whatever the philosophers may or may not say, common sense does assert that these statements do have truth values. I mean, if I say to you, had I got up 5 minutes earlier this morning, I would have missed the bus. I would have caught the bus. Then it doesn't normally occur to you to doubt that this is a meaningful statement. Similarly, if there's a murder trial going on and the prosecuting attorney says to the jury, had the accused not pushed his victim down the stairs, she would be alive today. The jury has to decide whether they believe that is a true or a false statement. So we do, in everyday life, we certainly do tend to, perhaps unthinkingly, assume that counterfactual statements do have truth values. So let's get on to the actual experiments which may perhaps bear on this question. I don't have to tell this audience about the basic setup of the EPR Bell experiments. I've drawn a very idealized version of this. Atomic source emitting two correlated microscopic particles, usually photons. Each photon switched into a switch, which will switch it into one of two measuring stations, which measure incompatible variables. For example, this counter B might ask the photon the question, are you polarized vertically or horizontally? And counter B prime might ask it, are you polarized 45 degrees this way or this way, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're all very familiar with this. So each of these measuring stations has the basic setup that I mentioned before. And in each case, the answer to the question is indicated by a genuinely macroscopic event out here. Then, of course, I'm sure you all know, we have the standard CHSH inequality, which says that all objective local theories, OLTs, satisfy this constraint. Actually, more than this, but this will do for our purposes. And, of course, the prism context, the point is that it is not so much that this inequality is violated by the predictions of quantum mechanics, but rather that prima facie, at least, is violated by the experimental data. We'll come back to a moment to that point. Notice, just because it's going to be relevant later, notice that if we are interested not in verifying the predictions of quantum mechanics, but rather in refuting the predictions of local realism, then the nature of the source, or even the use of a source at all, is inessential. If I get any kind of correlations, which, however produced, which violate this inequality, then prima facie, at least, I have falsified objective class of objective local theories. Now, in the the attempt to demonstrate the falsity of objective local theories has now been going on for well over 40 years, in fact. But until recently, there were a number of so-called loopholes. The first loophole regards locality. The event of switching to decide which measurement you're going to make may not be space-like separated from the detection in M2. In other words, just going back for a moment, the operation of this switch here may be, in some sense, so sluggish or slow that there is time for a light signal to be transmitted across to measuring device 1 before measuring device 1 actually makes a final measurement. That's one kind of difficulty, the so-called locality loophole. A second objection is that the freedom of choice relates to freedom of choice. The inequality only bites if the switching at the two switching stations is truly random, and it might not be. Finally, this is a so-called detection loophole. If the counters are not 100% efficient, then the detected particles may not be representative of the sample as a whole. Now, until a few months ago, many experiments had blocked one or two loopholes, but none of them had blocked all three simultaneously. Why not? Well, crudely speaking, the reason was that the blocking of one requires space-like separation of the switching at C1 and the detection at M2, and the blocking of two requires, again, space-like separation of switching at C1 and emission at the source, or the equivalent to the source. And generally speaking, it's easy to get this kind of spatial separation if you're dealing with pairs of photons, much more difficult if you're dealing with pairs of atoms. On the other hand, the blocking of objection three, it turns out, and this is a technicality, but it requires detection efficiency, which is greater than 82.8% for the original CHSH inequality. I'll talk about the Eberhard one in a minute. That getting this high degree of detector efficiency turns out to be easy for atoms, but difficult for photons. Now, as I say, in many experiments to date, one or two of those loopholes have been blocked. Each of these loopholes has been blocked in some experiment in the past. However, it has never been the case until recently that all three of them have been blocked simultaneously. And, okay, I think one would have to be a bit of a conspiracy theorist to believe this, but it could just be of a giant conspiracy of nature, which meant that whenever one of these loopholes is open, nature somehow managed to exploit it. And so he's fooled us all the time into believing that objective local theories don't work, whereas in fact they do. So in some sense, it's been a holy grail of experimental quantum optics for the last N years to try to block all these simultaneously. In fact, it turns out that it's very difficult to do this if you just use the original CHSH inequality. However, there's a rather interesting variant due to Eberhard about, I think, 20 years ago now, which points out that you can actually do something a little different. All that you need to do is to configure your detection station so that you simply measure whether a given photon, with a polarizer set in the direction A, all you've got to do is to measure whether a given photon gets transmitted and caught in the detector here. You don't mind whether, if a photon was not detected, whether that was because it had a polarization perpendicular to A, or it simply wasn't detected because of the efficiency of the counter. It turns out that, luckily, that doesn't matter. So the inequality, which Eberhard originally wrote down, is this, where what this means is, for example, that P plus zero is the subject to polarizations A and B, is the probability that with particles switched into detectors A here and B here, detector A fires and B does not, and so on and so forth for the rest of this these expressions. And it turns out, very interestingly, that this inequality itself is valid independently of the detection efficiency, eta. However, the prediction of the quantum mechanics violates only if eta is greater than 67%, which, however, is still rather better than the 82% that we had for CHSH. So it is quite an improvement. So the three experiments of which were published in November and December of 2015. These are the, I can't say these are the groups that did the experiment because they're all multi-institutional, but these are the first authors' affiliations on these. There's actually a substantial conceptual difference between the Delft experiment, which was done on electron spins with a rather large separation between the measuring stations, and the two other experiments, MIST and IQOQI, which were done using photon polarization and over much shorter distances. The Delft experiment did use correlated electron spins. The way they produced these, incidentally, is quite interesting. They did it by a sort of post-selection process. But remember, that doesn't matter. If you've got your violation, then that's definitive, no matter how you manage to produce the electron spins, which gave rise to the violation. So they tested the CHSH inequality. They got a value of k minus 2, K minus 2, you remember that the CHS age inequality says that K is less than or equal to 2. So if you find a value of K greater than 2, that's significant. And clearly, the larger the discrepancy, the more significant. So they got a value of K minus 2, which is about 0.42. This is, crudely speaking, this is what quantum mechanics predicts. The significance is not particularly high in this experiment. It was more a demonstration that you can do these EPR correlations with systems other than photons and at very large distances. But they did. The distances were large enough that they got around these three loopholes at the same time. The other two experiments both used both used photons, as I said. Distances involved are much shorter. That doesn't matter because obviously the photons are rather fast. They both tested the Eberhardt inequality, and this is the value of the violation of the Eberhardt inequality which they got. And at first sight, this looks incredibly small. You think this really can't have much significance. However, turns out that however small your violation is, if you've done enough experiments, then you ask yourself, what is the probability of getting this degree of violation in several billion experiments or whatever? And this turns out to be much more significant. It turns out that the claim is at least that for the NIST experiment, the probability of getting this violation by random fluctuations was less than about 2 times 10 to the minus 3. IQOQI actually claim a significance of less than 10 to the minus 30. That almost certainly is not really meaningful when you come to look at it in a bit more detail, but they certainly had a very, very small number here. So these experiments do seem to have blocked all three loopholes simultaneously. So does that mean that local realism is dead? Well, what are the outstanding loopholes? The first one is what is usually called superdeterminism. That basically means that you thought you were assigning, you're performing your switching at random. No, somehow nature fooled you. That was not true. The particular way in which the switch was going to occur on this particular event was predetermined from the Big Bang or whatever. That's a possible hypothesis, but I think almost certainly untestable in real life. So most people, I think, do not take that terribly seriously. Again, this is perhaps a little closer to the main topic of this conference. One possibility is physical retrocausality, the idea that the choice of measurement was made, or the actual outcome of the measurement somehow managed to propagate backwards in time to the source of the atoms or photons, and somehow affected. Again, it's not clear to me that this is really testable, though perhaps there are people in the audience who might have some ideas about that. The final loophole is of a rather different nature, I think, the so-called collapse locality loophole. In all the arguments in the literature about the EPR Bell experiments, the implicit assumption is always made, or almost always made, that there is a definite point in the operation at which a definite outcome was realized. It may have been when the photon passes or fails to pass the polarizer. That really isn't terribly plausible because there are other kinds of experiments, of course, involving Mach-Zehnder interferometers and so forth, where you could actually show that these two possible outcomes interfere. Well, then people say, well, maybe there was some outcome the definite outcome was realized at the point where the photon, having passed the counter, went into the anode, the photomultiplier, and triggered a shower of electrons. Again, well, that's not really what quantum mechanics says. After all, quantum mechanics says the state of the universe is still a superposition of a state in which the photon was transmitted and the shower was produced, and a different state in which the photon was reflected and no shower was produced. So that raises the question, at what point in the measurement process was a definite outcome actually realized? Quantum mechanics doesn't tell us that. That's the whole Schrödinger's cat paradox, basically. So this then raises the question, are there experiments of a different kind which may be able to say something non-trivial about this question? And that's the topic of the second part of my talk. Now, I should emphasize right away that at this point, we're going to be going away from talking about nice, clean, microscopic objects like photons and electrons and so forth, and start talking about really rather messy macroscopic objects like superconducting devices and so forth. In fact, I think if you'd asked 20 years ago, what are what is the chances that we're actually going to say anything useful about the foundations of quantum mechanics using systems like superconducting devices, these messy bits of metal sitting on lab bench, vibrating all the time, interacting with the black body radiation field and so forth? Most people have said, well, forget it. It's just too dirty. And indeed, it is still rather dirty, and we'll see that these experiments are not as clean as the ones in the EPR Bell field, but nevertheless, I think they're not entirely negligible. So the kind of experiment that we'd like to think of doing is the so-called macroscopic quantum coherence experiment, which very schematically goes something like this. Imagine that we have some reasonably macroscopic object which has available to it a couple, let's say for the moment, just a couple of macroscopically distinct states. And here is one example, a superconducting ring interrupted by a single Josephson junction. This device used to be called an RF squid. Nowadays it has a rather more glamorous name of a flux qubit, but it's the same object. And basically, the two states we're trying to consider now are a state in which the current is flowing clockwise and one in which it's flowing anticlockwise. And we'll come back in a moment to how large these currents actually are. But let's, for notational purposes, denote the counterclockwise flowing current as denoted by a variable q, which is plus 1, and the clockwise one by q equals minus 1. Now, the question is, could we start the system from, let us say, the clockwise state, allow it to progress to a point where quantum mechanics says that it actually ought to be in a quantum superposition of these two very different macroscopic states, and then look to see whether indeed it was by looking at the interference of these two possibilities at some final time here? So crudely speaking, so we start the thing in a definite, a known state at some initial time. We ask a question about the intermediate, its behavior at an intermediate time, and then we actually try to answer this question by looking at its behavior at the final time. Well, there are plenty by now. This line of experimentation has been going for something like 15 years and a little more. And existing experiments basically say that if the raw data is interpreted in quantum mechanical terms, then the state at the intermediate time cannot be a mixture of the two states, this and this, but rather it has to be a quantum superposition of these. Now, one question which we'll come back to, and we can certainly talk about in the question time if necessary, is how really macroscopically distinct are these two states? I'll just refer you to a little note which I put on the archive recently, which does discuss this question, as I can talk about it. But let's just suppose for the moment that we do count them as macroscopically distinct. Well, it turns out that you can, under certain assumptions, you can actually prove the analog of the CHSH theorem for macroscopic quantum coherence. Any macrorealistic theory, and I'll define that in a moment, satisfies the following constraint, which is very, very reminiscent of CHSH, as you can see, that the time correlations, if you make only measurements at single pairs of times, satisfies this CHSH-like relationship. We actually simplify this in this case by just setting T4 equal to T1, and then that gives you this relationship here. And it turns out, not surprisingly, that this is violated for appropriate choices of the times in question by the quantum mechanical predictions for an ideal two-state system. Basically, a prediction for an ideal two-state system is that this expectation value is proportional to the cosine of some characteristic frequency times T1 minus T2. Sorry, I think there's a typo here. It should be T2. Yeah. Yep. So that does violate it. Now, okay, what theory are we trying to refute? What's the definition of a macro-realistic theory? Well, first of all, the first ingredient is macro-realism per se, that is, the supposition that at any given time, whether or not I'm measuring it, Q of t is either plus 1 or minus 1. Now, in some sense, that's a little implausible, because clearly the system has to get from one state to the other. You can allow for that, and that's a technicality. So you allow for very short transit times, but apart from that, Q of t is either plus 1 or minus 1 for all time. Second condition is the absence of retrocausality. It turns out, in fact, that's not so essential, and one can actually modify the argument to, in some sense, get around that, but for the moment, let's put it in. The third ingredient is a little more tricky, and does not really have any simple analogue in the original Bell-EPR situation. Non-invasive measurability. Suppose that we arrange to couple the system so that if the system is in the plus state, it will trigger some measuring device, whereas if it's in the minus state, it will simply not interact with the measuring device at all. Then what we will do is to do a series of runs which, if Q turns out to be plus 1, that is in this state at here, we'll throw that run away on the grounds that, well, we interacted with the measuring device and that could have affected the subsequent development of the system. If it's in the minus state, however, we can keep it. And by doing a number of varying this arrangement appropriately, we can actually obtain full statistics on this quantity here. Now, if someone now comes around and says, this doesn't really prove anything, because even if the system was actually in this state, the minus state, and therefore not physically interacting with the measuring device, nevertheless, you might have affected it by making the measurement here. So in other words, crudely speaking, this clicker could either be here or here. I'm going to shine on a flashlight and say on this side. If I see the clicker, I will throw that run away on the grounds that I might interfere with its behavior. If I don't see it, then I argue that if I didn't see it there, it must have been here. And if it was here, I could not have affected it. So, in other words, will make this assumption of non-invasive measurement. If you deny that, I think in some sense you're really effectively denying the hypothesis of macro-realism in the first place. Because, I mean, if you think it really was here, but nevertheless you affected it by shining your light here, what do you mean by saying it was really there in the first place? So, now, the problem is that this hypothesis of of non-invasive measurability can't be explicitly tested. However, what you can do is to make it plausible by an ancillary experiment to test whether when Q of t is known to be plus 1, a putatively non-invasive measurement does or doesn't affect the subsequent statistics. However, for this to work, the measurements must be projective. The argument, as far as I know at least, does not work if they're not. There are a few existing experiments with macroscopic superconducting devices along these lines, but to the best of my knowledge, they all use weak measurement techniques, and at least in some cases, the states in question are not what you could really call macroscopically distinct. So I think it was necessary to try to do something a little beyond what has been done. And this is what was done in this NTT experiment, of which, as I say, I am a distant co-author. And it actually works rather more simply than the original proposal. Rather than measuring the two-time correlations, we simply check directly how far measurement, which is not necessarily non-invasive, at T2 affects the outcome at a later stage for the different macroscopically distinct states and, crucially, for their putative quantum superposition. So in other words, for any state, sigma, at T equals T2 minus, that's just before the intermediate measurement, you define this this quantity here, where M is a measurement with uninspected outcome made at T2, and zero denotes no measurement made at T2. In an ancillary test, you actually choose the state to be one of the two basis states. So you say, I'm going to prepare my system so that I know that it's in the, that it's definitely in the plus state there. I'm going to do a measurement, which I hope to be non-invasive, on it, and then look at what this does or does not do to the subsequent outcomes. Similarly for the minus state. And then finally, what I will do is, in the main experiment, is to either measure or not when quantum mechanics tells me that it's going to be in a superposition of these two states. And we'll define the difference, delta, between the effect of the disturbance when you did have a quantum, or allegedly you had a quantum superposition, the difference between that and the, actually I think there should be maximum value here, the maximum value of the effect of the disturbance when you are either in one state or the other. So in some sense, this is perhaps not quite so clean as the original two-time correlation proposal, but it basically has the same effect. Macrorealism will tell you that delta has to be greater than zero. In the experiment, it was found that delta is has this negative value here. So, at least at first sight, you have shown a violation of macrorealism. In fact, you've violated it by more than 84 standard deviations. So, what that seems to have told us is basically that realism, is in the sense in which I defined it at least, is not going to work either at the microscopic level, the level of photons or electrons, but it's not even going to work at the level of superconducting qubits. In other words, in the you have violated the condition we've shown experimentally. That, in the words of the late Asher Peres, unperformed experiments have no results, or more generally, that counterfactual statements have no truth values. Are we surprised? I think we ought to be surprised. As I say, the use of counterfactual statements and the assumption that they do have truth values is a part of our everyday practice at the macroscopic level. Sooner or later, if all this is really true, and if quantum mechanics is going to continue to work up to the level of everyday life, sooner or later, and it may be in the year 2200, or it may be in the year 5500, this is going to come back and bite us at the level of everyday life. So I think we'd better be prepared for this. Thank you.
I feel a bit tempted to argue a bit about philosophers here because it's a little hobby of mine, right?
Okay.
To study some older philosophers.
Yeah.
And I'd say the empirical philosophers, Kant, Schopenhauer, but also from Berkeley and so on, mm-hmm. would not have been surprised. In fact, they would see that as a vindication of their argument. I especially love Schopenhauer, who said that realism is redundant.
Yeah.
That inventing a material reality in addition to your experience is a redundancy. And that seems to fit this experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they would find fascinating here is we still haven't figured out what kind of physics really changes the appearance under the measurement? It's, like you mentioned that, it's, I think, a very important question. At what point in the events that happen, a physical system can really achieve this kind of reality that we kind of assume there is anyway? As I said, the empirical philosophers were very skeptical there and said, you cannot just assume that reality is there anyway, because all you know is the appearance.
Yes, indeed. Yes, well, philosophers.
Do you actually believe in the following thing? I have two cavities. The time is zero. I prepare the electron or photon in superposition, these two.
States between these two cavities, yes. Just a single electron. Right?
Single electron. And then I was sure that all the time the two boxes were filled.
Yes.
No, nothing was filled.
Right.
The time came when I opened this box and find the electron there.
Yes.
You see, you don't believe it. I have all the right to say that if I was to find to open this box earlier, the electron would have been there.
No, I don't think you have the right to say that. I think that, of course, what you, in some sense, is exactly what Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen were saying in the case of the Bell experiments. And I think that we've now shown that that's not correct.
Really?
I think, I would say that we have, in some sense, shown experimentally that no, you can't say that.
No, I think that one is to be very careful to test if your experiments actually rule out this possibility that I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, it does seem to me that it is. Would you agree that it's in the same spirit as Einstein, as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument?
No, it's not.
Einstein-Podolsky.
No, it's not.
You don't think it's the same?
No.
No? Okay.
I don't think about two inconsistent statements. Okay. Maybe the reason why I believe that there is a possibility to give truth value to this statement is because I was able to show if you have two boundary conditions for the microsystem, then quantum mechanics give me exactly the same position if I use the two vectors, one vector coming back and the other. And I use those to get statement, or I use the usual way.
Yes.
And therefore, there is some truth statement, truth value to what this vector coming back is saying me. So I'm saying that if I open the two boxes, I find a boundary here. Quantum mechanics allows me to take that information, send it back in time, and tell me what would happen if I would make an experiment in time in between. It's a counterfactual statement that quantum mechanics allows me to say that there's a truth value.
Well, quantum mechanics may allow it, but I'm not sure the experiment allows it.
What?
Quantum mechanics may allow it, but... Well, yeah, but you see, I think I'm not really arguing about what quantum mechanics does or does not allow you to say. I'm arguing about what experiment allows us to say.
But the experiment don't agree with that. At least we can find some statement that quantum mechanics is really wrong. And the question is then what would be the implication of that? Some position of quantum mechanics, now you say for sure is wrong. I've never heard that somebody can prove that some definite position of quantum mechanics is wrong. I claim that I can make, based on quantum mechanics, I can make a definite statement. And if that statement is wrong, experimentally, I believe we have to show quantum mechanics. Maybe we should argue about it some more.
Yes, okay. I think it sounds like a pretty something point.
Yeah. But you don't want to solve quantum mechanics away.
No. Well, not yet.
Come to your emphasis on counterfactual, unperformed experiments.
Yeah.
Wigner's proof of the Bell inequalities is a counterfactual argument. I'm talking about his American Journal of Physics argument.
Yes, yes.
And so we could say unperformed experiments in classical mechanics have no results, and in some quantum circumstances have no possible results, have no positive or real results.
Yes, sir.
They could have results in classical mechanics, but not quantum mechanics under some conditions.
Right, and but I would want to add also that it's not a question of whether you believe quantum mechanics or not. Irrespective of this, experiments have shown that they could not have definite results.
Yeah. You remember what he was doing? He said, if spin one goes through this apparatus at this angle, and spin two goes through this apparatus at this angle, then what would be the probability if spin one had gone through such at a different angle?
Yes, it's
and he uses this logic to advantage.
Yeah.
But quantum mechanics, we're always talking about projections.
Yeah.
So these the answers to these questions can be negative numbers, and therefore not.
Well, okay, we are talking, remember here, we are talking about real correlations of clicks and counters and things like that. And those numbers in some sense have to be positive, I think.
I'm wondering how these get modified, if at all, if you allow a probability statement to have a truth value. In other words, if you take the statement I set up 5 minutes earlier, I would talk the bus.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But you might say, if I'd set off 5 minutes earlier, it's an 80% probability that I would have caught the bus.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if we can transfer that to the quantum realm, and whether we're comfortable to talk about probabilities, and whether that makes a difference to whether or not So, is it counterfactual statements that exclude statements about probabilities have no truth values? Does it actually include statements about probabilities?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I hesitate to answer it because I always find myself totally confused about the very notion of probability.
Yeah.
It's one of those sort of typical philosophical questions where one has something that knows perfectly well how to operate in real life, and yet when you come to think about how you do it, I find it very, very confusing. So until I really have a definition of the meaning of the statement, that there is a probability of 80% that I would have caught the bus, I think I'm not in a position really to answer that.
I mean, maybe this is something that's as important to address as that, because just as statements about realism with truth value do make sense in terms of our us-sized lives, however hard they may be to relate to quantum theory. So I think it's also the case that statements about probability not only make sense in terms of our us-sized lives, they're actually rather important in our us-sized lives.
Yeah, indeed, certainly. Yeah, and I mean, I suppose one could speculate that the probabilities which one would assign in this way will turn out to be closer and closer to 100% as we get closer and closer to our everyday lives. I think it's a very good point. I really haven't thought about it, but I agree one should.
I mean, take an everyday example. Is it safe to do such and such?
Yes.
100%? Never.
Yeah, of course.
That's 100% safe.
Yeah.
And people actually get in a tangle because they're not thinking about sensible probability statements.
Yes, indeed.
One last question.
Yeah. You mentioned that you do not believe that quantum mechanics is universally valid. So where would you search for the limits of validity of quantum mechanics?
Well, good question. When I started seriously thinking about this sort of issue around 1980 or so, I would have taken an even bet that by the time you got up to the level of superconducting devices of the kind that we're now routinely operating in the laboratory, something would have gone wrong with quantum mechanics. Now, of course, in the light of the work of the last 15 years or so, I have to be much more conservative. But I do believe that if we push the predictions of quantum mechanics and experimental tests of these predictions hard enough in the direction which, crudely speaking, corresponds to the path from the atom to our everyday experience, that at some point something is going to fail. Now, I would like to make, if I could just take a moment to make an analogy there. Translate yourself back in time to the year 1875. Why do I say 1875? Because at that point there's absolutely no evidence whatever experimentally that what we now call classical mechanics, what they would have called simply mechanics, was ever going to fail. The only argument that something must have gone wrong is the Gibbs paradox, which was in fact formulated in that year. Gibbs and his contemporaries didn't seem to take that very seriously. They held it to be a minor accounting matter. If we go back with the wisdom of hindsight, we can see that looking at the Gibbs paradox, they should have been able to infer that at some stage, on the way down, as it were, to the atom, classical mechanics was going to break down. They would not have known how it was going to break down. They certainly would not have known at what point it was going to break down, but they would have been able to infer that it must break down. I believe that we're in a similar situation, going upwards, as it were, from the level of atoms and electrons to everyday life. The Schrödinger's cat paradox, to my mind, essentially tells us that at some point, quantum mechanics has got to break down. Again, we don't know at what point it will break down. We don't know in what way it will break down. That it will break down, we know, I think.
So you don't believe in it in any way, then?
Sorry?
You don't believe in the
many ways. I think for the sake of my blood pressure,
I'm not going to...